Accession number 10295, reel 10.
Still in reel 10.
Right. By run of it, I mean Chung Kai. I knew it like the back of my hand, and people knew me. Because every evening before I started work, or just after I'd started work, about 9 o'clock, usually it had gone dark or just going dark, I used to walk around the camp perimeter. And it would take a good half hour to walk around. And I think I walked mostly just to, I don't know, air my mind, ease my mind or whatever, and make up my mind what I was going to do at the night time, because in the cookhouse, it was a hospital cookhouse, and we had to try with what little bits we'd got, which was rice, vegetables, and the occasional egg. We had to decide what we was going to do, you know, appetizing for a meal. And occasionally we'd get meat, of course. But on this particular night, so I say it was either June or July, they'd killed these three lads in the march. And I was walking round, and I got over on the eastern end of the camp, that's right. At one side of the camp, the river run. At the bottom end was the cemetery. At the top end was the railway. And at the end where I was walking was the jungle. And there was a path went round. It was just an ordinary dirt path, but it had been walked so often it was more like a concrete path, like a path going through a park. And everybody used it. But once it started going dark, people didn't go out. They went to the bungalows and they stayed there. They'd have a sing-song or smoke or just go to sleep or whatever. But for idiots like me, I used to walk around the camp. I was a bugler. There was other buglers with me. Sometimes we'd take positions up in the camp at four positions, and one would start sounding last post or lights out or reveille or whatever, and the other one would pick it up, then the other, and then the other. So there was a continual echo of sounds coming around the camp. Quite good, actually. Eventually, the Japanese made it, or didn't make us, but they asked us if we would do it for theirs, you know, their dead, which we did occasionally. But this particular night, I was walking through this path, and as I say, it's very unusual for anybody to be around. You might pass a Japanese guard or whatever, and he wouldn't be bothered because you're inside the compound and you're walking through. And this particular night, there was some shouting going on and gruff noises and Japanese shouting in Japanese. And there was a meek voice saying, no, 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 whatever. You know, I walked, and it's just round the corner. And the Japanese sentry got his rifle and bayonet fixed, as they always did. And he'd been walking round. And there was a young Australian lad there, about 19 or 20, ex-sailor. And the Japanese was trying to get him to bend down because he wanted to sodomise him. And the Australian was pleading. And the Jap, I remember it distinctly, placing his rifle against the bamboo or against a tree, and it was leaning against a branch. But that's all I do remember of that, because when I did come back to realisation what I'd done, I'd grabbed his rifle and I'd just about chopped him up. I hit him with the butt, as far as another butt was covered in blood. I must have jabbed the bayonet into him, because he was dead anyway. And the Australian was screaming on the path. And I think he was shouting, mercy, mercy, or something. So I said, get the fuck out of here, and told him to clear off. And as he did do, I plunged the rifle down in disgust, I remember that. And I part kicked, part pushed the Japanese into the jungle under the bushes. And then I went back and I reported to Colonel Strauss. And I must have been in the right state, I was, you know, covered in blood. And Tappy Hall, he was the ex-boxer. Before I got to Strauss, I went to Tappy Hall and told him what I'd done. And he said, Christ, lad, you better go and tell it to an officer. There's not much we can do. But before you go here, and he grabbed all the bucket and sluiced me down with it. And I think it was more or less to bring to my senses rather than to wash me, but in doing it, he'd taken a lot of the blood away. And Colonel Strauss had a little cabin at the side of the hospital cookhouse with a canvas flap on it. And I remember going to him and telling him what I'd done. And he said, you're bloody joking. He was a Jew, actually, Strauss. I said, I'm not joking at all, and I was all a dither. I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do. He said, leave it to me, boy, leave it to me. Go back to your duties. You know, I was still shivering. He said, better still, don't go back to your duties. Go and lie down. And at the back of the cookhouse was a place where you could go and lie down on some matting. But there's no good lying down, you couldn't do that. And anyway, he took it in hand from there. And what he did, we had 20,000 prisoners in the camp. And we had over 2,500 dysentery patients in the hospital. And he arranged then, sent a runner to the different wards to tell people, the orderlies, that any man wanted to go to the toilet, to the latrines, they had to use a particular latrine. There was four latrines at that section, about 10 altogether, but four in that section. So he closed them all down and just left one latrine. And he had a man posted to make sure that everybody used this one latrine. And the Japanese was dumped into that latrine nearest to the dysentery. And the next morning it was filled in. It was filled in with shit first, and then we filled it in with soil after. His rifle's with him now. And I was useless then. It was hopeless. I couldn't do anything. Couldn't work. I was shattered. And Strauss then got in touch with, I think his name, yeah, Sergeant Colgan, Chris Colgan.
Colgan,
another Irishman. He was Irish. Got in touch with him, and he sent for me. And he said, what I'm going to do to try and get you out of the way. He said, as far as the Japs are concerned, the man is missing. There's no telltale marks there, there's no blood, there's nothing there. Everything's been cleaned up. And the body's been disposed of. You've got absolutely nothing to worry about, providing nobody saw you. And I said, well, is this Aussie? And he said, don't worry about him. He'll be taken care of, you know. And what they did with me then was to make it worse so they couldn't find me, they put me with the Japanese engineer section, which is about the worst section of any battalion you could be with. They were the real bastards of the Japanese army. They were really thoroughbreds. And I had to go then with the Japanese section. And from there, I toured, I think, just about every prison camp along the railway line.
How was the Australian sailor taken care of?
I don't know. I think myself that what they probably did with him was to send him down the other way, to Malaya. Somehow or other, he was taken out of it. I never even knew his name. I don't know what it was. My blood was up. And, you know, there was nothing I could do about it. It's not as though I was doing anything to try and be brave. I wasn't trying to do anything like that. In my mind, I'd had enough. You know, I'd broke. I'd reached the end of my rope, and that was it. And, of course, I belted the poor sod. And the truth of the matter is, though, that when the war finished, when we were up in Rangoon, Chris Colgan gave me the Japanese dog tags. He said, there you are, there's a souvenir of the only Japanese that you know you killed. And when I came home, the wife will tell you the same thing. She remembers me doing it. When I came home, I sent it to Japan, care of the Japanese government, to say that if you're looking for this man, he's buried at Chunkai, and he's buried under a pile of shit. Well, I didn't say why he was there, but I said exactly where he was, and that was how I felt at the time, you know. And I sent the dog tags. But that's neither here nor there. But from there, got one or two different dirty jobs. But to go to a more, say, humorous aspect of it, we was working at one particular, it was Chunkai, and the river was in flood. And I was then 22, 23 years of age. And I'd only just learned to swim. I'd only been swimming about 12 months, 18 months, something like that. But a lad out of the Suffolks, Royal Suffolks, he'd taught me how to swim. He'd said to me that all you've got to do is throw yourself in. You know, stand up in the water, throw yourself forward like that, and just keep kicking your feet. And I took him at his word. Because I'd always been practicing somebody throwing me in or, you know, doing that things. But he said, no, just stand there, put your hands out like that, kick your feet, and you'll go. So I took him at his word. He said, one thing before you start kicking, and that is, if you find you're getting in difficulties, turn on your back, flap your hands like a seal, and let the river take you away. Which was bloody good advice. Because I did exactly as he told me, went out like this, kicking my feet. And as soon as I come to put my feet down, there's no ground there. I was in the middle of a swollen river. And I turned around, ready for gasping, and start doing this. And I remembered what he said. He said, throw yourself on your back and flap like a seal, you know. So I started doing this. And I finished up about half a mile down from the camp. The river had taken me and flung me against the bank. So it was good advice. And then from then on, you know, I started swimming. But on this particular day, as I said, the river was in flood. And there was one or two of the lads bathing there. We used to go around and put water in big containers for the hospital and things like this. And one of the lads, who was a swimmer, got into difficulties. He got cramp. And he was shouting help. But he was treading water, all right, you know. So two of us went in. And the other lad, I got so far, and then he went back, and I carried on. And I grabbed this bloke, and I grabbed him round his neck, you know, underneath his chin like this, and started doing the dog paddle. It was a left arm out, that's right, and got my right arm round him. I was doing the dog paddle, going back, kicking with my feet, you know, pushing my hand out and doing this. And I'm strangling all the time I'm doing it. And we got to the bank, and threw him on there, and he's gasping. And by the time he got his breath back, you know, he called me all the names under the sun. He said, why don't I take up life-saving? Why don't I learn bloody life-saving? He said, you've half kicked my bloody back in. You've choked me. He said, I don't know whether I'd better off staying in there or letting you bring me out, you know. So I said, if that's the way you feel about it, bloody well jump back in again. You know, I was ready for walking away. And as we did it, there was a Japanese soldier come running down. Stay, everybody stay, you know. So I thought, oh, bloody hell, what have we done wrong now? And he stood there, rifled, you know, in their way of being at attention. And the gun soldier came down, sergeant. The same one that Davis is on about, his name was Saito. He did no more than say, you know, are you the man that pulled the other man from the river? So I said, yes. Very good. And he's given me a carton of cigarettes. Red Bull cigarettes. For my bravery.
He was called Saito.
Saito. Sergeant Saito. So that was my present for saving somebody's life. But that's the type of people they were. You know, one minute they'd be pandering to you, and the next minute they'd be knocking your head off. So, anyway, from there, I then did practically every line up to Nicky. Rintin, Nicky, and onwards. I didn't get
what were they called?
Rintin and Nicky. I didn't get as far as Tambazai. And then they called us all back again because they were sending men to Japan, further parties to Japan. And I was then put on a party that was leaving Chunkai. They just then started the bombing raid proper. They were bombing the Kwai Bridge and one or two more places. And I then went from there up to place called Uttaradit in Chiang Mai province. Now Uttaradit is a province now. And there was 99 of us in the squad. And the sergeant was Kiyuki. K-I-U-K-I, I think it was. Or K-I-U-K-Y, Kiyuki. It was something similar to, you know, the soldier in that the town like Alice, I think it's called. No. There's a Japanese prisoner of war film where there's a Japanese soldier goes around with the children, hawking them all around in Malaya and Borneo. Well, this sergeant was very much like him. Sad sack. A real sad sack face. And he was a bastard like all the rest. But he was a sad sack. And when we got up to Uttaradit, as I said, there was only 99 of us. And we got up there sometime at the end of 45, or the end of our term. It was around about June, July. We got it up to such a fine art that There was three of us. Myself, a lad called Don McIntosh, and Brian Beck. Beck died about 3 or 4 months ago. But McIntosh is still alive. He's up in Newcastle, I think. Gateshead, somewhere, aren't they? But what happened was, we used to go out at night time, and at the side of the prison camp where we were, there was a row of houses. Nothing else, just this row of houses. And we used to watch them in the morning cooking the meal at the back. And there was a little girl there, about 10 years old. Never knew her name. But she used to come to the fence, and she'd try and talk to us. What little bit of English she knew. And she used to say, cigarette, you know, cigarette, do you want a cigarette? And she'd give us a cigarette. And we finally got the way around to where she said to us, tomorrow, come here at 6 o'clock in the evening. She would wait, and she would take us to her house. You know, I say, there was three of us. So we made a hole in the wire, and we got through and went to the point where she said. And she was there, 6 o'clock, followed around, and went to her house. And there was her mother and her father, and just this little girl. And the mother had been cooking rice in the back section. And she brought it in, and we couldn't understand each other. We didn't speak the same language, but we tried to communicate. The mother was saying to me, you, how much? You, how much? She was meaning to me, how many children have I got? And I thought she was asking me how much I would pay to go to bed with her 10-year-old daughter. You know, and I said, rubbish, no way, no, no. So in my way, I was saying no, 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 that I didn't want her daughter. And she was thinking, I was saying, no, I've got no children, I don't want any children. It was very complicated, you know. So while we sat there, we sat on the floorboards, you know, and there's this pile of rice in front of us. And suddenly there's two guys come in at the back of us, two policemen, Siamese. And they've got rifles. And they went and started yattering. And I've always said, if you're going to point a rifle at somebody, use it. No, and he didn't. And I grabbed all of it and slung him straight across the bloody room. Don McIntosh, I tell you. I slung him across the room and grabbed it and prodded it to the other fella. There's no bullets in it. There wasn't even a magazine on them. It was just the bare rifle stock. And the other fellow was the same. And they shit themselves, a pair of them. And apparently, they'd come as a joke. It was the bloke who was giving us the meal. It was his brother and his brother's mate. They were in the police, but they hadn't got anything like this. You know, any rifles. They were just dummies. You know. Anyway, it's all passed on fairly well. You know, they were quite happy about it. We all sat down and had a meal of rice and fried egg. And that happened 2 or 3 times, went over there. And then, late August, somebody told us that there'd been a bomb dropped, or two bombs dropped, a magic bomb. And these Thais were trying to tell us. And there's a Siamese chap trying to tell. I've got a letter from him in there, he's 87, and he remembers it. He was trying to tell us that the war was over. And this must have been the end of August, near the end anyway. And we went back, back into camp, and told our Sergeant Major, because we'd only got a CSM in charge of all of us. And would he go and see to the Japanese, you know? No, 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 don't do anything, don't do anything. If our people want us out, they'll come and all this bullshit, you know. Now, down at the side of us was the main railway line where the Japanese were coming in from Burma, or going out to Burma. Chiang Mai is the stepping off point. And round about the 30th of August, a plane had been over and they'd dropped pamphlets. But the Japanese wouldn't allow us to have any of these pamphlets. And then one of the Thai women passed me a pamphlet which said that the war was over and that the Japanese were to release us. And it was given in 3 or 4 different languages. But the Japs still wouldn't have it. No, you stay where you are. No. Well, by the 9th of September, and the war had been over since the 15th of August, I'd had enough. And me and McIntosh, Don McIntosh, and Becky, we'd formed a clique, the three of us. We decided we was going to go. We'd had enough. So we walked towards the main gate, and there's a Japanese on guard there. And as we walked towards him, he's shouting to us in Japanese, where you go, stay where you are. And we said, no, bullshit. And he did a rattle with his bolt, you know, to tell us to stay where we are. And he's shouting towards his guard room. And they were shouting back, and between them they're shouting orders and commands to one another. But nobody's doing anything. So we went out through this. It was just like an ordinary palm yard gate. We just pushed it open and walked out. And the sentry started rattling his bolt. And I said, well, if he's going to fire, he's ticking a bloody long time over it. Let's go. And we carried on. Well, you can imagine there's three of us. All we got was a japapi. It's like a G-string. You know, with no other clothing. Bare feet. And as we're walking up the road, who should come running after the Kiwishi sergeant. And don't go. So we're going home. No, he said, bad Japanese. And what he was trying to tell us was that the Japanese were coming down from Burma on trains and that the town would be full of them. So he said, stuff you Japanese, we're going into town. And he was chasing after us, you know. And we'd got into the village, actually. And it was just an ordinary, typical Siamese shopping area. Dirt roads, but with all the goods on the front and all this and the other. And we could smell coffee coming from one, so we went towards that. And Kiwishi came with us. And he must have thought to himself, oh, sod it, you know. If they're going to do it, I'll join them. So he goes into this so-called cafe. And we sits down. Coffee. With no money. And the Thai came over, or Siamese came over, and gave us a cup of coffee each, a little cup. And then the Jap took over, the sergeant, and he ordered whiskey. So we had the whiskey and the coffee. And then the Thais kept coming in, different ones would come in and give us a drink. So by now, the three of us, we'd got plenty of courage, plenty of Dutch courage. You know, we'd take on the Jap army. So Kiwishi said, it's Mishi time, you've got to go back for your dinner. You know.
What time?
Mishi time, dinner time. M-I-S-H-I. So instead of going to the camp the usual way, we took Kiwishi with us and we went onto the railway sidings. And we said, that train is mine. And, oh, no, Japanese soldier said, no, that train is mine. And he argued, you know, and I finished up, my train. And, oh, no. So, what do you call it? Brian Beck, said to him, you stay there and we'll go and get the lads. So we shot into camp and we said, come on, it's over. And the sergeant made us shout, no, they'll shoot you. Sod it, come on. And we all went, and there was just three carriages. They were all open. Four carriages all open, plus the diesel engine on the front. And we all piled in. Even Kiwishi came in with us. And we left where Utaradet. It had taken us days to get up there. I think it took us 2 days to get back down. But as we were leaving Utaradet, the paratroopers were looking for us. And a plane flew over. And as it was flying over, we saw three men, drop out. Two of them opened and the other didn't. And you could watch the man candling, you know, as he came down. And we'd forgotten the incident, actually, until about half an hour later, and the train was stopped by these paratroopers with all the gear on, and they're there with the rifles, you know, stop the train. And it was a Siamese that was driving us, you know. He stops the train, and these lads get on, who are you? Where are you from? And we had to give them details of who we were, where we were from. It was Sergeant Major, whoever he was. I've forgotten his name, but we just sat on him, say, you know, you're bloody useless, and we did all the talking. And it turned out the guy who candled was a fella called Major Musket. How he spelled it, I don't know, but he was a paratrooper. His name was Musket. He'd come to rescue us and killed his bloody self. And we got as far as Bangkok.
And on the train?
Yeah, on the diesel, yeah. Got down to Bangkok, and then our own people came to meet us then. And Sergeant Kiwishi, the last I remember of him, I gave him a 28-pound bag of brown sugar for him and his wife. One of the lads gave him a tin of ghee for cooking with. And we gave him one or two bits of odd notes that we had and told him he could have the train. And that was it, you know, be on his way. And he was crying, his tears streaming down his face, you know. He'd been a hard bastard in his time, but he was crying, he was upset. He wanted the war to carry on. But we'd had enough. Anyhow, from there they took her into a prison camp at Bangkok, where we stayed overnight. Well, we stayed two nights. That's where Lady Mountbatten came to see us. Unfortunately, the day or the morning that she arrived, I didn't know anything about it, her arriving. But somehow or other I'd been struck blind. Couldn't see a thing, couldn't open my eyes. And I was walking around, but nobody bothered. You could just bump into things, you weren't bothered. And I was making my way to the cookhouse. You knew where the cookhouse was by the smell. And I was making my way over there. Not only that I knew some of the lads that was on there, but I knew I could get a bath in the cookhouse. And I went over, started having a shower, stripped off. And then so I remember someone shouting to me, "Get yourself dressed, there's a lady present." And I didn't see her anything, you know, she'd come through. Apparently it was her. But whether she saw me or not, I have no idea. I couldn't care less anyway. But I got myself dressed. And then, just after she'd gone, was called to the office. And they gave me some kind of eye ointment anyway, which I put on my eyes. And you know, it was a bloody miracle. The next morning, perfect. Nothing wrong with my eyes at all. I was great. So once my eyes were okay, I was right the rest of them. I wanted to get home. So they sent for us at the office, and each one of us was given a pile of money, Siamese money. Some men got $200, some got 50, some got 150. Didn't matter. They just took a wad of notes and said, "There you are. Go and enjoy yourself." And it was all brand new, British printed Siamese money. So we went out on the streets, and there was quite a number of Siamese people, women. They wanted blonde-haired babies, and any blonde-haired prisoner, they wanted him to go and sleep with them. The only thing is, majority of the prisoners then got the bloody stamina to do it anyway. You know, there's no way. So from there, I was flown out to, not flown out, we drove out to the Aria aerodrome at Siam, or the Siamese aerodrome. And when I got there, there was everything was laid on for us to have a drink and something to eat. Nothing elaborate. And then the next morning, we was to we was leaving Siam and we were going on to Rangoon. And we all had to parade on like a big what do you call them? Hangar, outside a big hangar. And on the opposite side and to the right of the hangar was a brick wall, with a lot of bricks missing. And running from one end, there was two stanchions, and running across the top was a beam, and hanging from that beam were ropes.